listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Israel Hilton is 49 years old. He's worked his entire life in retail customer service. And couldn't get health insurance through his job. He makes, his income last year was $13,334. He lives in Texas. Now, $13,334 is too little to qualify for Obamacare. And the way that, to buy health insurance on the exchanges, to get a subsidy. If he'd made $17,000 a year, he could have gotten health insurance for free. With Obamacare, I believe it was 17 is the beginning point. Might be a little bit higher. And you know, you'd get a subsidy from the federal government and he would be buying it from, you know, Blue Cross or Aetna or whatever on the exchange in Texas. And if he made under $2,000 or under $3,000 a year in Texas, he could qualify for Medicaid that's paid for in part by the state, 56% by the federal government and 44% would that be, I think, by the state. But instead, because he makes $13,334, and Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, said, we're not going to take the Medicaid expansion from the federal government, an option that was provided to him by John Roberts in the U.S. Supreme Court, when Republicans petitioned the Supreme Court to knock down Obamacare. Because of that, he was caught in the donut hole. He can't afford health insurance. He's making too much to get the health insurance for really, really, really destitute people, the Medicaid program. The state did not expand the Medicaid program for Obamacare, and he doesn't make enough to qualify for Obamacare. And he has been diagnosed now with terminal brain cancer. And the doctors are saying, you know, he'd been having these headaches. He just didn't go to the doctor until finally the headaches turned into seizures, and he was afraid to go to the doctor because he didn't have insurance. When they became a seizure, he ended up in the ER, and that's where he was diagnosed. Oh, and first, the neurologist said he had depression and sent him home. Seizures stopped for a while, then they came back with a vengeance. He finally goes in. Well, he has no choice. He's having seizures. He's taken to the ER, and they scan his brain, and, okay, this guy's got 18 months to live. The doctor said, you know, if we've actually treated him earlier, if somebody diagnosed him, he might be alive. But he didn't have health insurance. So he really didn't have that option. And he did go to the ER, and they did say, well, you know, sorry, it looks like you're depressed. See you later. So why would Rick Scott turn down this money, and why would anybody think that this is not only a good thing but a moral thing to tell Israel Hilton, just go die? Ed Heiselmeyer is with us. He's a senior research fellow with health policy studies at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. And, Ed, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
I think this puts you in an odd position because Obamacare, complete with the Medicare expansion, was first created by you guys, was it not, Heritage?
No. No, not at all. What they did was they took some of the concepts and reworked them. And it's kind of like, I like to tell people, it's kind of like giving your wife or your girlfriend a box that says Tiffany on the outside, but there's actually something else inside it that Tiffany didn't make. So,
okay, something
I mean,
from
they
Walmart.
Try, they try to claim, you know, but, you know, for example, the exchange, I mean, you know, that was designed to create defined contribution, multiple choices, lots of variation for people who are stuck in one-size-fits-all employer plans. Instead, they're using it to reduce choices and access. But anyhow, that's be that as it may. Talking about the Medicaid expansion, why expand or why not expand? It was interesting. The story you were relaying,
This is the red state donut hole. You have 25 states where Republican governors or legislatures have created this red state donut hole.
Well, they haven't created it, first of all. The law creates it. Secondly,
John Roberts.
Well, okay, one can argue that
The Supreme Court created it.
Well, several.
But governors have the choice of having it in their state or not having it in their state.
That's right.
And Jan Brewer, the Republican governor of Arizona, said, I don't want this donut hole in my state.
Well, they actually, it's very interesting. The reason Arizona, and I was not surprised that Arizona adopted it, Arizona actually did this, extended coverage to this population on a waiver before the passage of PPACA, and had 10 years experience with it. And so it would be one of the few states, and the administration wouldn't play ball and let them continue that without adopting the expansion. So they were forced into a situation where they either had to adopt the expansion or throw people off the rolls that were already on.
So, you know, but bottom line, Ed, how is Rick Perry in turning down, first of all, in not allowing Texas taxpayers to have their own money back from the federal government?
How is he not
either complicit in murder or malpractice?
Not murder and
or malpractice.
Well, first of all, let's remember also here what's going on. I mean, the individual you're talking about, if that individual is single, they would qualify for exchange subsidies because the federal
government. He's married with children.
Ah, okay. Well, then you know, yeah, for a few more dollars of income, they might qualify.
Yeah, if he was making $16,000 or $17,000, he could have had Obamacare. But
right,
but
so,
you know, this is the problem of these people who are the working poor.
Here's the interesting thing that's going on here. Keep in mind that he is not representative of this population. In other words, when you look and you say, who will be added to the Medicaid rolls? Is it kids? Nope, they're already on to that level. Is it disabled? Nope, they're already on. Is it the elderly? Is it pregnant women? No, they're already on. The people who will be added to the rolls are able-bodied adults. Now, this is important, and furthermore...
Like Israel Hilton.
Right. And furthermore, but unlike this gentleman... between three quarters, or well, actually, even in poor states, at least because I was just in Arkansas, at least three quarters of those people do not have dependent children. In other words, they have low incomes,
right,
but they're able.
So we should just say, screw them, let them die.
No, nobody said that. Remember, keep in mind what's going on.
Well, that's what Rick Perry's saying.
No, that's not what he's saying.
It's absolutely what he's saying.
No, come on, you know better than that.
No, I'm telling you, I'm drawing a moral line in the sand here.
But
Rick Perry is either committing murder, or he is the worst governor Texas has ever had, and he should be impeached.
I know you have an ideological agenda, but let's stick to
this. This is not ideology.
Well,
this is a man dying because this governor chose this policy.
Let's stick to the facts here. The facts are that going back a couple decades to something called EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, hospitals cannot turn people away at the emergency room. So, as you pointed out, this gentleman
passed during the Reagan administration, but they don't have to provide them with anything other than triage.
No, they do. They have to provide them with more than triage. And furthermore, and this is very important, furthermore,
this brain cancer was diagnosed in the emergency room, and the hospital said, we can't treat this. You know, this is not.
That hospital may not be able to, but some other hospital might. Now, furthermore, here's
might?
The point. We have been.
This is your solution?
No, I'm just telling you, people get the medical care and it gets paid for. That's the point I'm trying to make. People today who are uninsured and have medical problems, they don't necessarily get it timely. That's a problem, and they don't necessarily get the best. That's
this is absurd. If this guy had Obamacare and he had gotten treated early,
well,
instead of it being a very expensive,
early, that's the other problem. But the point is, in this situation, we already are spending hundreds of billions of dollars on hospitals to cover the cost of care for gentlemen like this. The point that I was going to make is, though, the vast majority of the people who would be added to the rolls by Medicaid are not only able-bodied adults, but they do not have dependent children, three-quarters of them. Half of them are between 19 and 34. Now, the interesting thing about this is you saw the report that came out from the Congressional Budget Office last week. In fact, I'm writing something on
this. Ed, we're just about out of time. You got to get to your point.
The point is that CBO says if the state does not expand Medicaid, those individuals will have an incentive to work more to get on Obamacare subsidies. If they do expand Medicaid, they'll have incentive.
So what Israel should have done is he should have worked extra hours to get his income from... He should have taken a second job.
Well, the point
this is all his fault.
No, it's not his fault. The point is, you can find a solution for him without adding hundreds of thousands of able-bodied young adults to the rolls in the process.
Okay, Ed, you got the last word. Hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Ed Heiselmeyer, Senior Research Fellow with Health Policy Studies at the Heritage Foundation, heritage.org. Ed, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Andrew Campbell with the Big Picture, senior producer of the Big Picture, on the line with us. Andrew, tonight we've got Florida cuts off minority voters starting out.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to John Nichols of The Nation. He's always a great guest. And we'll be talking about Florida County Board of Commissioners in Manatee County has basically eliminated nearly a third of polling sites in that county, and it just so happens that that county has a heavy African-American population. Mm-hmm. So I don't think there's any coincidence here. We know what's going on here. We've seen it over the last, arguably since Obama took office, and even before that, that Republicans are trying to eliminate voting sites and obstruct the ability for Americans to have a say in our democracy.
Wow. Wow. Then we're going to do the Lone Liberal Rumble with Cameron Seward and Andrew Kloster.
Yep, they're both from the Heritage Foundation, and we'll start off, we'll get their take on what Florida's doing. And, I mean, is this just a coincidence, or is this really more of the war on voting and the war on democracy being waged by Republicans? Hmm. We'll also get into Rand Paul. He's filing a lawsuit against President Obama and the NSA over the NSA's domestic spying programs. Is this a political move, or does this actually have some merit? And will it go all the way to the Supreme Court? We'll get into that.
That should be interesting.
And then we'll also touch on Washington's governor putting a hold on the death penalty, citing a variety of issues with it, including the fact that drugs that were once used for the death penalty are being withheld by the companies that make them because they don't want to use them death penalties. So now we're having to resort to more barbaric ways. And really, let's just get rid of the death penalty altogether.
Right. I'm with you. Block C, have we cleared guests yet for that?
Yeah, Block C, we're going to have Stephen Cohen on. He's the co-editor of The Nation magazine, and he'll be on to talk about the media bias, or the over-coverage of the U.S. media of the Sochi Games, and talking about things like the doorknobs falling off in streets.
Oh, I think it goes way beyond that. I think that what's going on is we've got the old neocon crowd that wants the Cold War back. Yeah, because it was very profitable for them, and they could make people very fearful. And I mean, it's just like, you know, there's an article on Alternet today that's like, you know, 10 nasty things about Russia. You could say probably pretty much the same things, at least 8 or 9 of them, about the United States. And it's just it's amazing. Anyhow, back to you, Andrew, in Block D.
In Block D, we'll have our Olympic update, talking about the latest coming out of Sochi and what's going on over there. We'll also have a smart capitalist on. A group of smart capitalists are headed to Capitol Hill, and they're actually trying to show support for the minimum wage and try to get lawmakers in Washington to take some action so Americans can afford to live, really. So that should be an interesting discussion.
Cool. Okay. Sounds like it's going to be a fascinating evening. Andrew Campbell, thank you so much, Andrew.
Should be a great show, though.
Okay. Good. Yeah, good talking with you. I see we have 20 seconds to fill here. Or not to fill, but 20 seconds to fill. So let me just recap this guy's story. This is Israel Hilton. This is over at the Center for American Progress's blog, Think Progress, How Texas Healthcare Failed Israel, a man with terminal cancer who'd worked his entire life. And the solution apparently is he should have worked more because he only earned $13,300. This is because Rick Perry said no to the Medicaid money, and he said no to the Medicaid money because he's trying to sabotage Obamacare. He told Texas taxpayers, like Israel Hilton, you paid federal income taxes, but you can't have your tax money back in the form of health care. Sorry, you're too poor. We'll be back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy. A lot that I wanted to talk with you about today. Let me just get into some of this stuff. First of all, there's a piece in today's New York Times, an op-ed by Mikhail Saakashvili, the former president of the Republic of Georgia, that country to the south of Russia, with Ossetia. South Ossetia and Abkhaz. What's the name of the other country? It's not. I want to say Kazakhstan. It's not. It's Abkhaz. Anyway, these are two little countries to the north of it. And he's talking about how wonderful his country is, although he lives now in the United States. Why aren't you still there? Abkhazia. That's the other one. And it's really, you know, his op-ed is titled Tsar Vladimir's Illusions. It's really, you know, basically trashing Putin and Russia. And, you know, thumping his chest about how wonderful Georgia is. He's now a senior statesman at Tufts University Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. So, you know, here's the question that I have for Mr. Saakashvili. And we've invited him on the program. We invited Karl Rove on the program. So far, we haven't heard back from either one of them that they are willing to come on the program. Let's step into the Wayback Machine and go back to 2008. Now, 2012 was a presidential election. President Obama was reelected. 2008 was a presidential election. President Obama was then Senator Obama running for election against then Senator McCain. Well, he's still Senator McCain. Senator McCain, who, by the way, was arguably the most corrupt of the Keating Five. Charles Keating had just lavished McCain with things. This is Tom Fitzpatrick, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, back in 1989, talked about how Keating was basically had funded campaign McCain's first election to the Senate from Arizona. Keating was one of the guys that went down in the savings and loan scandal. He was the worst of the bunch. He was a grifter, con man, and he poured six figures into John McCain's political campaigns. Threw fundraisers for him, made a sweet shopping center investment deal. Well, here I'm quoting Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Tom Fitzpatrick. He even made a sweet shopping center investment deal for your wife, Cindy. Your father-in-law, Jim Hensley, was cutting on the deal, too. Keating saw you as a prime investment, so he flew you and your family around the country in his private jets. Time after time, he put you up for serene private vacations at his vast palatial spa in the Bahamas. All this was so grand. Right. And this, so John McCain is running for president, this guy who was somehow avoided prosecution. Maybe it was because we had a Republican president and a Republican vice president when the Keating Five went down, when the SNL crashed, the whole thing crashed. Keating went to prison, but not McCain. Anyhow. Karl Rove was subpoenaed to testify before Congress, and Nancy Pelosi had the power to enforce this subpoena. He was testified to appear before the United States House of Representatives in a congressional hearing that included questions about the Don Siegelman case, free-don.org, if you want more information on that. This was July 10th through the 13th of 2008. Karl Rove did not show up. He defied the congressional subpoena. He said, "Yeah, screw you guys." Sort of like that woman is doing in the Chris Christie case right now, you know, who used to be his right-hand person that MSNBC is all over. So Karl Rove decided not to show up. Said, "Sorry, I'm out of the country." Where was he? He was in Yalta. What was he doing in Yalta? He was meeting with Saakashvili. This is in July of 2008. Now, earlier, you know, about 4 months earlier than that, the McCain campaign had paid this consulting firm that was run by Randy Schuneman $70,000. And the same guy, according to Yahoo News, Pat Buchanan for Yahoo News, the same guy, Mr. Schuneman, was paid over $200,000, at least his Orion Strategies company, from the regime of the Georgian state run by Mikhail Saakashvili. So anyhow, Karl Rove is in Georgia. He meets with Saakashvili. A few months later, guess what? In August, Georgian troops launched a massive assault on the breakaway province of South Ossetia on Friday, taking control of much of the region and bringing Georgia's U.S. allied government closer to the brink of a full-scale conflict with Russia. Well, Russia pushes back and takes back some of that territory, but this was started by Georgia. So John McCain goes, to the Senate and says, this is going to be a real foreign policy test. Does Barack Obama even know where Georgia is? That kind of thing. I don't know if that's a verbatim quote, but the words to that effect. I know the region. I need to be president. We could be in a war with Russia. You need me. I'm a war hero. It didn't fly. I mean, it was a good try. Didn't fly. So after the election, John McCain votes with the Senate to hand Saakashvili and Georgia $1 billion, according to news reports. What's going on here? Is this a bunch of neocons trying to revive the Cold War?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And is Saakashvili playing the role of the useful idiot? And, what's really going on here with all this Putin bashing? So let me just wrap this up. My theory, and this is only a theory, I have no evidence other than just a fairly, I think, obvious timeline to support it, is that you've got this guy, Randy Shinneman, who is providing PR and campaign advice to both John McCain and Mikhail Saakashvili, the head of the state of Georgia, the Republic of Georgia. In the months running up to the presidential election of 2008, Georgia provokes a confrontation with Russia that provokes a response from Russia that causes John McCain to go be the public face of Georgia, basically running around going, we got to do something about this. And Barack Obama's not up to the task. This proves that Obama shouldn't become president. McCain's running for president. He's the Republican nominee. For example, this from a news report, Senator John McCain's top foreign policy advisor prepped his boss for an April 17 phone call with the president of Georgia and then helped the presumptive Republican presidential nominee prepare a strong statement of support for the fledgling republic. The day of the call, a lobbying firm partly owned by that advisor, Randy Shinneman, signed a $200,000 contract to continue providing strategic advice to the Georgian government in Washington. Okay. So, was John McCain using Saakashvili in the Republic of Georgia basically as a prop, as a stunt to try and win the campaign, the presidential campaign of 2008? I think so. I think it's fairly apparent. But it might not be. Did Karl Rove set this up or help set this up? Rove ignored a congressional subpoena and instead went to Yalta and met with Saakashvili. Just, a month or two before the war started. Maybe. Certainly it was convenient for Rove. It gave him an excuse to ignore testifying before Congress about what happened to Governor Don Siegelman, free-don.org. And now we've got all of this chest thumping about how terrible Russia is and how noble the United States is. And Saakashvili, now it's become how terrible Russia is and how noble the state of Georgia, the Republic of Georgia is, in today's New York Times, calling Putin all kinds of names. Now, I'm not here to defend Vladimir Putin or Russia. He can do that quite well himself, and the country has a lot of warts, just like any country does. I mean, I was surprised to see this piece in Alternate the other day about, I don't even want to get into going through the point by point because I don't want to appear to be an apologist for frankly any other country. I'll apologize for my own country from time to time, but the point is that it seems to me that there is an effort going underway, going on, you know, an ongoing effort in the United States to restart the Cold War because, you know, the American people have no taste for war in the Middle East anymore. And we've got to have an enemy. You can't have a Cold War. You can't have a huge military-industrial complex. You can't justify, you know, $400 or $500 billion a year going to the Defense Department, more than, you know, the combined defense spending of every other country in the world. You can't justify that if you don't have an enemy. And if President Obama is actually picking off the terrorists, whether you like drones or not, and Al-Qaeda has been largely decimated, and the American people are saying, get the hell out of the Middle East. And even Obama, you know, he wanted to have a war in Syria, and the American people basically said no, and he backed down, and he said, okay, no. And Putin came in and saved his bacon. I mean, Putin came in and said, you know, he said to Assad, give up your chemical weapons, and we'll stop this thing. President Putin also helped with Iran. I mean, two real serious foreign policy crises where Russia came in and helped the United States. And so why is the former president, former president of the Republic of Georgia, trying to basically provoke a conflict between the United States and Russia? It just all strikes me as odd. So, number one. And number two, how can Rick Perry claim to be anything other than responsible for the death of Israel Hilton? This young fella, 49 years old, this guy who has worked his entire life at close to minimum wage in the retail sector and now has brain cancer and is dying of it and can't get health care because Rick Perry said no. There is an organization, by the way, that has started in Texas. It's called Texas Left Me Out. They have a website, and they're trying to collect stories from some of the 1.5 million Texans who will not be covered because Rick Perry said no. This is just, it's criminal and immoral. It's just astounding. Tim in Lawton, Michigan. Hey, Tim, thanks for watching. What's up?
Hey, you're talking about all my favorite people here today. I think next time you see McCain, you should tell him to come back and start a war with Mexico. That way, well, we already know how to annex Mexican property.
Yeah, it worked great for James Polk. 15
or 20 more states, and half of them wouldn't even fight against us. No more border problem. The cartels could all go to Delaware and file as a 501c4, and that way he'd win the election with their money.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, Karl Rove, was he ever...
You've actually thought this through, haven't you?
Blowing Valerie Plame's cover.
Yeah.
You know, that's a lot worse than what Snowden did.
Yeah, well, I don't think that was Rove. I think that was the vice president. His Scooter Libby was the chief of staff for the vice president. Karl Rove worked for Bush.
I can't get all the facts right all the time.
I understand. But you really thought through that let's do a James Polk, you know, let's do a President Polk thing. You know, that was, by the way, the one thing that Abraham Lincoln was really angry about was the Mexican-American War. He thought that was just a totally unnecessary loss of life. But in any case, Tim, thanks for the call. Tongue-in-cheek, I realize. Ross in East Carbon, Utah. Hey, Ross. You wanted to talk about Medicaid?
Yes, sir. My wife has a neurological problem she's had all of her life, and we're running in the same problem that people in Texas are.
You're in the donut hole?
I'm disabled. I'm on Medicare. I have a COPD,
mm-hmm.
And we're just in the... problem where I make a little bit too much money to apply for Medicaid and not enough money for her to get medical insurance. I called my senator. I've called the White House. I've called everybody I can, and nobody can seem to help us out in this part of the country.
I would suggest, Ross, that you call the local newspaper and say, I've got a story to tell you that I think you might find interesting.
Well, Tom, you have to realize we live in a Republican state, you know.
I understand, but, you know, occasionally it'll...
We don't want to help any... You know, I think we should take all of our troops out of Afghanistan and start helping our own people and, you know, all these...
As Merle Haggard said, rebuild America first.
Well, I just wanted to get off that of my chest. You know, everybody's saying, well, maybe we have to get a divorce because then that way she could get Medicaid. Why should I have to divorce my wife for 33 years?
Yeah.
Just so she can get health insurance. I mean,
because the,
not right either.
All because the governor of your state is refusing to take the Medicaid expansion in Utah. Is that right?
Yeah, that's true. But
okay. All right, Ross, thank you
I
for
mean,
that.
I mean, my wife has diabetes, and I haven't been able to take her to the doctor to have her blood sugar test because she has no insurance. I can't afford a medication.
Oh, God. I'm so sorry to hear that, Ross. Ross, you really, really should call your local newspaper and tell them, you know, I want to talk to a reporter. I've got a story. You should cover this, if I may be so presumptuous as to suggest. Or somebody else, you know, who could speak on your behalf could tell your story. Ross, thank you for the call, and I wish you the very best. Steve in Perrysville, Indiana. Steve,
you
wanted to talk about the same topic in Texas?
My friend lived in Texas. He was one of my best friends. He died because they kicked him out of the hospital.
Mm.
It was a better hospital. He had to go to a public hospital.
So they kicked him out because he couldn't pay because he didn't have insurance.
Yeah, he didn't have any insurance, and he died because of their stupid, rules about, you know. And when he got to the other hospital, they just kept putting him off and putting him off until he was so bad that he died.
Yeah.
Because that way they didn't have to spend all the money to help him out.
That's really sad. You know, there are over 5 million people. We have 1.5 million, going on 2 million people now, who have been denied an extension of their unemployment insurance by a Republican filibuster 3 days ago in the United States Senate. And now you've got 5.5 to 6 million people all across the United States who are being denied access to health insurance. Because they're working, because they're making too much, they're making over $3,000 or $4,000 a year. They're making too much to qualify for the destitute insurance, but they're not making enough to qualify for Obamacare in those 25 states where Republican governors or Republican legislatures have said, no, we will not take the federal funds. It's mind-boggling. Steve, thank you for sharing your friend's story, your story too. 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So should Rick Perry be charged with something like, I mean, is this moral murder or legal murder? Shano asked the question, is Rick Perry a one-man death panel? Seems like it. Yeah. Amazing. Amazing. Carol in Dillon, Montana. Carol, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite Network.
Good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, we used to have catastrophic health insurance through Medicare.
Uh-huh.
My husband was on it when he spent 80 days in the hospital in intensive care.
He's over 65.
Okay. No, he was 53 when he passed away.
Wow. So Medicare used to cover people under 65?
Yes. Yes, and thanks to George H.W. Bush, he got rid of that. And the effective date for termination was February 1st. My husband died January the 28th, 1990.
Wow.
But yeah. And before that, he was getting most of his care through the VA hospital until George H.W. Bush canceled that, too, and cut it back to service-connected only.
Wow. So much damage from the Reagan Revolution. It's astounding.
Oh, boy, isn't there.
It's astounding.
No, I think Rick Perry should be held accountable for anybody's death.
Well, hopefully the voters will do just that and hold him accountable in the next election. You know, he's running for re-election as governor, and he'll also probably be running for president in 2016, although I don't think anybody's really going to take him seriously, but who knows. But this guy has done so much damage. I mean, people are dying. It's a terrible thing. Carol, thank you for calling and sharing your story. I appreciate it. Thank you. In Ottawa, Iowa, Randy, you're on the air. Hey, Randy, you want to talk about Chuck Grassley?
Tom. I received my local paper, the Ottawa Democrat, today.
Mm-hmm.
And at the bottom of the page, there was a comment about Senator Grassley, and he commented on Obamacare, and that's what the title of it was. Grassley comments on Obamacare. According to the CBO, the law will hurt economic growth, cause the loss of 2.5 million jobs, and add $1 trillion to the deficit.
Mm-hmm.
Is that accurate,
to
your knowledge, sir?
No,
it is not.
It is.
Where can I find the, so I can, I'll get that later.
Yeah, I would, first of all, here's what the CBO said. The Congressional Budget Office said a little over 2 million people who are stuck in dead-end jobs or are working full-time when they would prefer to work part-time, or who want to become entrepreneurs but are afraid to start their own business because they, all of the above, all of these folks are afraid to leave their work because their health insurance is tied to their work. It's called job lock. That job lock, when that is unlocked, when all of those people qualify for Obamacare, you're going to have some people who are working a 40-hour week who really would rather work a 30-hour week and can afford to, and they want to be home when the kids come home. They're going to cut back on their hours. You got some people who are wanting to become entrepreneurs. They're going to do that. Basically, what the CBO said is you're going to have 2 million people leave the job market. That doesn't mean 2 million jobs are going to go away. There's 8 million people standing behind them waiting to jump into the job market, the unemployed, who will take those jobs. So there's going to be no loss of jobs whatsoever. It's just going to be people are going to be happier. Randy, thank you for the call. By the way, don't forget our third hour. David Loy is going to be with us, the psychologist and evolutionary systems scientist, founder of the Darwin Project, to blow up this myth that Charles Darwin said survival of the fittest is how nature works. Charles Darwin actually didn't say that. And I think you're going to be fascinated by it because conservatives have attributed Darwin's theories to economic theories that were promoted by, I think his name was Herbert Spencer, as I recall, Darwin's cousin or nephew, who was promoting this whole survival of the fittest thing as an economist. And they've used Darwin for years to justify Darwinian economics, or a.k.a. Reaganomics. And Darwin never said that. Rodney in Chicago Heights, listening on CPT, WCPT. Hey, Rodney, what's up?
Tom, how you doing?
Good.
I was just watching your conversation with Mr. Hasselbeck, yet another example of compassionate conservatism.
Well, he's not, Ed is not here to defend himself, so let's not pick on him. But let's talk about Rick Perry. Rick Perry is a public figure, and he very publicly said, we're not going to take this money. So.
Yeah, well, yeah, and, poor guy, what's his name, Israel, he ain't got a chance.
No,
and I'm kind of in that mix. I'm not quite poor enough to, qualify for the Medicaid expansion, but yet, not enough that where I could afford the so-called affordable health.
Well, you live in Illinois. Illinois took the Medicaid expansion, so you should,
yes.
Have you been to an Obamacare website and looked up, what it would cost you?
Yes. And, it's either you pay $300-$400 a month even with the...
subsidy.
The subsidy.
Right.
And so you get a low deductible or a lower deductible or, maybe $100-$200 a month, and you get it like a $5,000, $7,000 a year deductible.
Right.
And who could afford that when you're in a major metropolitan area and it takes everything you get just to live?
Yeah, so you must be making somewhere in the neighborhood of $30,000 to $45,000 a year.
No, it's under 20.
If you're making under 20, Rodney, you can get pretty much free health insurance on Obamacare. You need to go back and check the stats.
Yeah, and and that free health insurance, it's not going to cover very much.
Not true.
That you would get.
Not true.
Yeah, well, that's been my experience.
Well, your experience should include going to healthcare.gov and plugging in your information. Go create an account and go through the process. I think if you're making, you know, $20,000 a year, you're going to qualify for.
I've done that, and it's not that affordable.
Yeah, I'm not. Pardon my skepticism, Rodney, but I walked through it here in D.C. and it's. I mean, I didn't put in that I earned $20,000 a year, but I've seen the numbers and I've seen the schedules, and you should qualify for damn near free health insurance in the state of Illinois on Obamacare, and I encourage you to go check it out. Kevin in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing today?
Good. You want to talk about pain meds?
Well, yeah, but first I'd like to mention about Georgia. You know, this just sounds like a continuation of the big news Zabrinsky doctrine. And, you know, he's a Georgian refugee fascist who got the Russians to attack Afghanistan until they ruined that country.
I thought Brzezinski was from Poland.
No, he's a Georgian.
Are you sure?
I'm positive.
Huh. Okay.
I spent a lot of time studying the world history and stuff, and
yeah.
I would almost wager a bet on it if I had any money.
Yeah, well,
I'm on Medicare. And
you're in good shape anyway. I don't bet, so.
Oh, and neither do I. That's advice that I never had, and I never.
Yeah, Shane just looked him up on the Wikipedia machine or whatever, and Brzezinski's from Warsaw, Poland.
Well, I apologize then.
Okay.
You are right.
All right.
But
So let's get back to the pain meds that you wanted to talk about.
Well, yeah, the federal government now is starting to crack down on Schedule 3 and Schedule 4 pain meds.
Schedule 3 would be things
like Lortab, Norco, Vicodin.
Okay, Vicodin, right. Whereas and Schedule 4 is what? Is that more intense or less intense?
Lesser stuff, codeine, and then Ultrams and stuff.
Uh-huh, okay.
Then you've got the Schedule 2s, the Oxycontin, morphine,
right.
Oxycodone, Percocet and stuff.
And then Schedule 1 is heroin.
Yeah, which isn't supposed to have any value at all in
right.
medicine.
Right.
But it's actually, with them, you know, cracking down on the prescription pain medicine, it's going to turn people into heroin buyers.
Right.
Because they've been prescribing the very hard narcotics for 20, 30, 40 years now.
Here's this.
And
here's,
now they're jerking the rug.
Here's my analysis of the situation, Kevin. Tell me if this makes sense. Inequality grows in the United States as a result of 32 years of Reaganomics. As inequality goes up, people are more and more unable to find work, depressed, bummed out, unhappy. You see actually mental illness going up and depression going up and all these things that are associated with inequality. So people turn to drugs. In many cases, they turn to prescription drugs, to painkillers, and they get addicted to these painkillers. They end up, you know, going to heroin as a result of that. Opiate addiction is a serious thing. And so the government's response to this, instead of reducing inequality and putting people back to work and making sure that people have good jobs, because people with good jobs are generally not interested in becoming addicts, the government's response to this is to crack down on doctors who are writing prescriptions. This makes no sense to me.
Well, and this, I think, is the end game. We have flooded Iran and the Soviet and the Russians with a lot of heroin from Afghanistan.
Well, Afghanistan has flooded them. Yeah.
So they're doing the same thing to the American people to put us down and keep us in a coma. There's going to be a huge increase in the heroin supply, and that's going to fund
yeah.
the CIA.
I don't disagree, Kevin. I think to a certain extent we're seeing the war coming home. Afghanistan is the biggest, you know, producer of poppies in the world, and gee, we happen to have all thousands of troops there.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back, Tom Hartmann here with you. The Moral Monday program is continuing. That was started in part by the Reverend William Barber, the president of the North Carolina NAACP. His website, RevWilliamBarber, BARBER.com. And we've been following this. There was a huge event this last weekend. We've been reporting on it. We reported on it before. We reported on it after. The corporate media in the United States seems to have completely lost it, though. I don't get this. Reverend William Barber, back with us. Thanks so much for being with us again, Reverend.
Hello, Tom. It's always good to be with you. And, you know, today, February the 12th, is the 105th anniversary of the founding of the NAACP.
Wow.
I'd like to give that website, if you don't mind. It's at ncnaacp.org, where your listeners can go to. That's ncnaacp.org.
As in North Carolina, NAACP.org.
Yes, sir.
NC.
Yes, sir.
Okay, you got it. So tell me about, you know, how did Saturday come together? Who was there? What happened? And why, in your opinion, has it been ignored by virtually all of the corporate press in America?
Well, let me just say, you know, we've been organizing this Forward Together Moral Movement in essence for about 7 years, called the Historic Founding of Jones Street People's Assembly. But, of course, last year there was such an intense attempt to regress the state, to take it back. It was our governor and our Speaker of the House, Tom Tillis, and Senate Leader Berger and Governor McCrory and Financier Art Pope led their allies in one of the most regressive paths we've ever seen in North Carolina in recent history. We challenged those laws as being immoral, what we call constitutionally inconsistent, morally indefensible and economically insane when you deny 500,000 people Medicaid or cut 900,000 people's earned income tax credit or take 170,000 people's unemployment and roll back voting rights and roll back women's rights and attack the LGBT community. And we saw a massive outpouring of people, black, white, Republican, Democrat, young, old, Native Americans, Latinos, gay and straight, say no. And we had 13 Moral Mondays in Raleigh. The last one had about 10,000 people. Then we went on the road. And this Saturday, that coalition, about 200 organizations led by the NAACP, came together. Some reports say more than 80,000 people were there. And we came together of every different fabric of North Carolina saying no to this kind of extremism, not to Republicans and not the Democrats, because we believe there are some progressive Republicans and progressive Democrats, but we have to isolate this kind of extremism, and we do it best when we challenge them on deep moral and constitutional values, and then also point out that the immorality and the unconstitutional also lead you to policies that are economically bad for everybody.
And so, brilliantly said. So who showed up and you know, what happened on Saturday?
Well, we've had what we call the mass moral march on Raleigh to ignite another year of direct action, litigation, voter registration, voter mobilization. The crowd that was there, Tom, represents, I think, the New South. You know, we contend that if you're going to change America, you have to think states and you have to think southern states. But the way you have to do it is you have to engage in what we call indigenously led, agenda-based fusion coalitions that is deeply moral, deeply constitutional, anti-racist, anti-poverty, pro-justice, pro-labor. So that's what you saw show up. There were Republicans in the crowd. There were Democrats in the crowd. There were white. There were black. There were people of every demographic. Some from out of the state, but the majority were people from right there in the state. There were all of the major denominations, Baha'i, Hindus, Muslims, Buddhists, Christians, coming together saying the Jewish community. The Jewish community, Tom, actually, many of the rabbis had their Sabbath 45 minutes before the march so they could participate.
Hmm.
It is, and all of us said, when it comes to the issue of justice, treating the poor right, lifting up those on the margin, paying people living wage, taking care of public education, making sure people have health care, those are all fundamentally, those things fundamentally fit within the framework of all of the moral traditions of our great religion. And even secularists were there who don't necessarily believe in the faith the way we do, but they believe in a moral universe. They believe in things being done right. And that's why we saw the full tapestry of North Carolina and the nation. And we believe it's a model that is taking root, the spirit of it. It's breaking out in Florida next month. It's breaking out in Alabama next month. Georgia has had one start. South Carolina has something called Truth or Tuesdays. Because this is the way we can challenge this Tea Party extremism and no longer allow the so-called far right wing to have the quote-unquote moral high ground where they limit moral issues to things like prayer in the school, abortion, and how people feel about homosexuality.
Wow. It's extraordinary, and I think you're right. I think that we're seeing the South change. I think we're seeing America change, and I think that there's some really, really fundamental change going on. I've been reading this book, and I'd love to get your thoughts on this. The book is called When the Irish Became White. And the premise of the book, and it starts out in the early 19th century, the 1830s, when the abolitionist movement in Ireland, about American abolition, started getting really, really aggressive. But the point of the book is that when the Irish came to America after the potato famine in the 1840s, they were not considered white, in quotes. Mm-hmm. That white was really a code word for basically upper middle class, the folks that were being let into society. And the Irish weren't included, the Catholics weren't included, the Jews weren't included, later in the 1890s, the Italians were not included. And that really, for much of American history, and there were, in many cases in northern states, there were freed slaves or what you call African Americans today, who were considered white legally under the law. And that what we're really looking at is far more a class construct than a race construct. And in large part, the reason, and to extrapolate that logic, I would say one of the reasons why we're seeing now so many white folks, in quotes, racially white, whatever, getting involved in this, is that the privations that have been, dumped on black folks for 100 years, following slavery, following Reconstruction, of poverty and institutional misery, are now being foisted upon white people as the middle class is being eviscerated, and all of a sudden they're waking up going, hey, wait a minute, and now let's join with our brothers and sisters. Am I onto something here?
Well, I think first of all, you're exactly right. I have not read that book. I know I heard of the title. But I think this whole business of how we racialize issues and depending on certain time frames in history. For instance, if you go back in American history, there was a time that things like kindergarten and Social Security amendments that happened in 1954, Medicaid, Medicare, certain kinds of loans for working families to get houses had very popular demand. And then, in what I call the second Reconstruction, 1954, say 1968, but toward the end, there was this white Southern strategy put in place to specifically, in some sense, racialize programs, call them entitlement, and suggest that those people were getting something and they were taking from other people.
Right.
There was a big email on this big piece on Google where Lee Atwater actually explained it, and he said they went to code words. They no longer use the N-word, in other words, but they use words like tax cuts,
right,
and states' rights and forced busing. And he said that they used that because most of those policies would have a negative impact on African Americans, but more importantly, would cause white Southerners to vote against their own best interests. What this movement does and what every fusion movement must do is expose to people the myth of extremism.
Yes.
And that is that you can hurt a small subset of people without hurting everybody. So you're exactly right. When yesterday a white Republican runs up to me on the street and hugs me and says, I'm a Republican, but I'm not with this extremism. It is because he understands that when you cut 500,000 people Medicaid, you hurt everybody,
yeah,
white, black, young, old. When you take 900,000 people, as our government legislates, this earned income tax credit, and make Ronald Reagan look like a liberal because he supports earned income tax,
yeah,
credit, you hurt everybody. When you take unemployment, you hurt everybody.
Absolutely right. Reverend Barber, hang on just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I so apologize for these hard breaks. We have to take them. Reverend William Barber, RevWilliamBarber.com, NCNAACP.org. Thank you, sir.
Listening to you earlier, you're the first pundit I have heard talking about the 2 million jobs not being lost, but as people left those positions, they'd be replaced with other people. I'm surprised I haven't heard that every time, but you're the first person that got that right.
Well, and in fact, it would lower the unemployment rate. I mean, isn't that a good thing?
However, I think you're missing part of that.
Okay.
What would happen is some people, and you pointed out that somebody working 40 hours might decide to work 30.
Right.
She still has a job, and then they'll hire somebody else probably to pick up the other 10 hours. That not only maintains the current job, but adds some. And the people leaving as entrepreneurs are going to start a business and hire people.
Right.
So it may expand employment, not cut 2 million, but actually add some.
You're right. You're absolutely right.
That's a point I haven't heard anybody make, and it'd be nice if people started doing just that.
Oh, I, and the outcome, you know, of people basically being happy with their lives rather than miserable with their lives. I mean, basically what the CBO did is they identified a couple of million people. I'm surprised the number was as low as 2 million people. That they identified,
yeah.
They said you got 2 million people out of 115 million people in the workforce in America. You got 2 million people who are so miserable in their jobs in aggregate. I mean, it might actually be 5 or 6 million, but because some of them are going to go to part-time, so we're taking slices of people to compile into one person, if you know what I mean. 2 million people worth of 40-hour work weeks. That, and I'm guessing that probably in aggregate it was 4 or 5 or 6 million people, but it still seems like a surprisingly small number of people to me who only are working because, under the circumstances that they're working, because they're doing it, because they have to do it in order to get health insurance, because it's tied to their employer. This is a program.
Yeah,
go ahead.
And you're exactly right. Those jobs won't be lost. There'll be somebody who really needs a job that's going to take that job decision.
Right.
And I think others would be created.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And when people are happier with their lives, they're more likely to be more productive. And when people are more productive, it boosts the economy and, you know, the entrepreneurs, as you correctly pointed out, and all these other things. So, you know, I came out when this CBO first came out with these numbers, that, you know, the next day I came out and I said, this is not a bug. This is a feature. I mean, this
it is.
You know.
We should highlight it. I have one other comment. You, Reverend, on from North Carolina. I'm from Raleigh, and he's doing a fantastic job.
Mm.
And I read just the other day that since the Republicans took over, the state is losing jobs faster than any time in the history of the state's existence. We've lost nearly 100,000 jobs since they took over.
Well, that's what typically happens, you know. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I'm assuming that from a Republican point of view, that's a positive, but from mine, that's a real negative.
Yeah, well, from their point of view, it's a positive because what it does is it loosens the job market, which drives wages down, drives profits for corporations up.
As far as I can tell, yeah.
Yeah, and that's their logic. You know, the higher the unemployment. This is what Alan Greenspan said, you know, that his job as chairman of the Fed was to maintain a, quote, certain necessary minimum level of worker insecurity, end quote. In other words, keep people scared that they're going to lose their job and keep the job market so loose that if they do lose their job, there's five people waiting for it, and you can drive down wages and destroy unions. That's what it's all about. And that's why the Republicans are freaked out about the fact that a couple million people might leave the job market, which will reduce the unemployment rate because a couple million people who are currently counted as unemployed will suddenly be counted as employed. Mark, thank you for the call. Brilliant. We'll be right back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. In the previous hour, I had raised my conspiracy theory du jour that the Georgian invasion of South Ossetia back in 2008, very conveniently just a few months before the presidential election, was in part organized by Karl Rove and the McCain campaign. The McCain's senior foreign policy advisor was also a lobbyist for, or was a member of a lobbying firm, a part owner of a lobbying firm that was providing strategic advice to the government of Georgia at that time. This, we're talking about the nation of Georgia on the southern border of Russia. And that, and, you know, we're seeing the apogee of this today with Mikhail Saakashvili, Misha Saakashvili publishing his op-ed in the New York Times titled Tsar Vladimir's Illusions. And it just gives me the creepy crawlies that we have to have an enemy. That I think the Cold War is being revived. And, you know, we'll see where this goes. Corky in Hilton, New York. Your thoughts on this?
Hello, Tom. Yeah, I might talk about reviving the Soviet Union.
Well, what I'm suggesting is that what McCain and the other neocons are trying to do is they're, you know, we need to have a threat, and the Al-Qaeda threat has diminished. And so, you know, they're looking around the world. The Chinese threat, if they really made that into a threat, it could become actually seriously dangerous to us. So they're going to go for Russia. You know, odds are we're not going to have a nuclear war with Russia, but they can scare the hell out of the American people for a while. And,
That's an analogy, Tom, because I'll tell you why. Back in the 60s, they had us hiding under our school desk.
I remember.
That's how bad the Russians frightened us.
Yeah.
And they're going back to try to capitalize on that fear.
Yeah. You know, 1956, 57, I remember those, the alarm. I was 6-7 years old in first and second grade. I think they stopped doing it sometime in the late 50s. Maybe it was the early 60s, but you know, it only happened for a couple of years, but the bell would go off and we would all dive under our desks and it was duck and cover, right? And you'd put your, and I still remember you have to hold all four fingers over your eyes and so that your middle fingers touch over your nose and then put your thumbs over your ears and close your ears with your thumbs. And that way when the bomb blast happens, your eyes won't be blinded and your eardrums won't be ruptured. You will be a cinder, but your eyeballs and your eardrums will be intact.
Yes, and the Americans opened their wallets freely.
Oh, we did.
The military industrial complex to protect us from those pesky Russians.
And not just the military industrial complex. My dad was, you know, seriously thinking about digging a bomb shelter in our backyard. You know, instead we had a basement in our house in Michigan, and we had several conversations about whether we should put a false floor above the basement and put, you know, a foot of dirt on it to protect us from radiation. And, you know, I mean, this was being talked about in the news. I mean, people were, and now there's a market for things like the dried food that they peddle on the Glenn Beck show. And, you know, all this survivalist stuff, you know, the woman who was, the mother of the kid who shot up Newtown. She was one of these preppers preparing for the apocalypse, preparing for the end days. Well, if you got a nuclear powered state out there like Russia, not nuclear powered, but nuclear, you know, weapon capable state, and you can turn them into the bad guys? Yeah, why not? It boggles my mind. Corky, I think you and I are roughly the same age, and we're seeing history repeat itself, and it's pretty concerning.
Yes, well, you can do that when people don't remember.
Yeah.
That's the problem. People don't remember the past.
Well, and that's why old farts like us need to get the word out. Corky, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Michelle in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Michelle.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, I wanted to get back to, Rick Perry,
yeah.
Healthcare.
Yeah.
We talk a lot about, okay, there's the greed of Big Pharma, there's the greed of insurance, but what we don't hear a lot about is the greed of the individual physician and that the money needs to be taken out of medicine.
I don't disagree with you. When we lived in Germany, a very close friend of mine, in fact, my neighbor was an MD, was a doctor, Dr. Goethe. And, you know, he earned the high end of middle class. I mean, it was, as I recall, now this is back in the 80s, it would have worked out to around 80,000 U.S. dollars back then, probably about 120 now, and or 130. And he didn't work for the paycheck. I mean, he was comfortable because of the paycheck, but he wasn't, you know, the doctors in Germany are not trying to become multimillionaires because you can't.
Right. And I don't... anybody needs to make a decent living. I understand that. But to give you an example, just down the street from where I live, there is a car company called Physicians Auto Group. And looking through their showroom windows, my guess is the bottom line starting point of anything they have to offer is about $50,000, and that's just the motorcycles. I find this to be – these people ought to be embarrassed.
Yeah. Well, some are, and there are. I mean, I think our general physician, RGP, the doc that Louise and I have, is probably just just making a good middle class, but she's running a private practice and, you know, with a couple of employees, it's a small business. It's those frontline docs, the general practitioners who are the upper end of the middle class and making appropriate salaries, but we're paying specialists amounts that are just mind-boggling. And as a result, you got people either going into medicine because they want to make money, which is the wrong reason, or choosing a specialty when they should be, you know, we need more GPs, we need more, you know, just basic family docs, but people are moving out of that because you can't get rich doing that. Or if you're going to get rich doing that, you have to limit everybody to 6 minutes, you know, and just crank through as many patients as possible, which is a lousy way to practice medicine. So I'm with you, Michelle. And this is the thing. If doctors... hey, Michelle, is there anybody that you would like to send flowers to for Valentine's Day?
Oh, my goodness. I could think of someone.
Okay, great. Let me put you on hold, and we will... we're going to send you a $50 ProFlowers gift certificate that you can use to give flowers to your special someone, thanks to ProFlowers.com. Michelle's on line 7, Daniel. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, Rick Perry, what do you consider him when Israel Hilton is near death here? What title should we give Rick? The bad and the very, very predatoriously ugly. Brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, EcoWine.com. The good. Olympic athlete activists. More than 100 Olympic athletes, including many Americans, have signed a petition urging global leaders to take action on climate change. Citing concerns that we may not be able to have a Winter Olympics 100 years from now, they're calling on countries to agree to push forward with clean energy efforts at next year's UN Climate Change Convention in Paris. The athletes who signed the petition, like American skier Andrew Newell, said that their experience with winter sports has opened their eyes to the dangers of climate change. As Newell wrote on the petition's website, as a result of this heightened awareness of climate change, many of us who spend our lives in the snow are more aware of its effects, that being climate change, and have changed our lifestyles to be respectful of the health of the environment. I'm not a scientist, but I know that as the snow dwindles, so does our water supply, our food, our health, and our economy. Unless our governments can stop letting politics get in the way of common sense, we're all in for some more sobering and painful environmental changes that will truly change the face of this planet. End of quote. Well said, Andrew. And good on you and your fellow Olympians for taking a stand against the greatest threat our species has ever faced. The bad. Carl C. The Arizona state representative has introduced a new bill into his state's legislature that would make it illegal for any undocumented immigrant to use any public resource whatsoever. That means public benefits, public roads, and yes, even public bathrooms. If someone is caught using any one of those things and is unable to verify their immigration status, that person could be charged with a misdemeanor or even a felony. According to Seal, his bill is really just a continuation of the proper role of state government in relationship to the federal government. But let's be honest, it's hard to see this as anything other than a total invasion of privacy that will result in the mass profiling of Latino Arizonans. And the very, very ugly, Tarek Hassani. The Filer, Idaho police officer is under fire today over how he responded to a complaint on Saturday about dogs running around a local neighborhood. Here's a clip from a local news report about the incident.
Just after 5:30 on Saturday night, Filer Police Officer Tarek Hassani responded to Jacqueline Circle for a report of dogs loose in the neighborhood. After talking with the neighbor who called in the report, Officer Hassani went to the house where the dogs lived and was immediately confronted by the animals.
He tried to get out of his car. Both dogs aggressed him at his door. He managed to get out of his car. Had to kick one of the dogs away.
What happened next has one local man ready to fight the city and the police department.
Finally, when he was kept trying to come up to the house to talk to the owner to get the owner to take control of the dogs, he ended up having to shoot the dog for his own safety. We never want to have to shoot a dog, but sometimes it happens.
To make matters worse, the dog was a service dog for his disabled owner and was shot during his owner's 9-year-old son's birthday party. That's insanely ugly. That's amazing. That's amazing. Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Paul, listening to KBCS in the Republic of Georgia. Paul?
Yes, okay.
You're not in the Republic of Georgia.
No, I'm in Seattle right now. I spend about three-quarters of the year in Georgia.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it? Have you read the op-ed that Mikhail Saakashvili wrote in today's New York Times?
No, I have not, but I will. I can fill you in a few things about Misha.
Misha is his name. He goes on at some length about how modern and wonderful Georgia is, and all these middle-class and upper-middle-class Russians are coming there for vacation because it's so much better than Russia.
I don't know about that. But anyway, Misha is one of these foreign leaders who was brought to the United States and went to an elite university and got trained to think American. He graduated from Georgetown University with a law degree and then went on to an internship in a firm in Wall Street. And he's always been a passionate hater of Russia or, particularly Putin. I mean, every chance he's been... His whole relationship with Russia has been extremely undiplomatic. I mean, every chance he gets, he sort of sticks his thumb in Putin's face. And he basically is a libertarian, and his economic policy was pure Washington consensus.
Yeah.
He privatized the entire healthcare system. Which is, the doctors get paid now, but it's hard to afford a lot of it. I mean, you have to go pay an insurance company unless your employer covers you. It's almost exactly the same as the United States pre-Obamacare.
Huh.
And McCain has been there a lot. He's been over there a lot. Him and Lindsey Graham, and there's another guy, I forget his name.
Wouldn't be Joe Lieberman, would it?
No, not yeah. Lieberman. Lieberman's more in Israel.
Yeah.
His party's called the United National Party, and they've been accused of a lot of embezzling and actually stealing. So they've been accused of stealing $2 billion worth of assets from various individuals and companies by threatening... tax actions against the people, and they end up taking over the company and selling it. And once his term limit was up last October, and the Georgians elected a president from the Georgia Dream Party, which is the party that basically defeated the United Nationals the previous October. And we took over most of the seats in Parliament.
So has he been replaced by a party that's to his left or to his right?
Oh, way to his left.
Uh-huh.
Not to his left, not way to his left. It was actually led by a billionaire named Benzina Ivanishvili, who was prime minister for a year and is very conscious about relying too much on one individual, and he actually quit his post because his job, he felt his job mostly was to get rid of Misha. And he also, Misha has now done what a lot of failures do, is they go and teach at an elite university. A professor at Tufts.
Right. Same kind of story with Lawrence Summers. What do you think about my theory that, particularly since Misha's advisor was this PR firm partly owned by Randy Shuneman, who was also, Randy himself was John McCain's senior foreign policy advisor at the time, that, so he was being paid by both of them, and this is not a slam on Randy, I mean, you know, this is what lobbyists do, but that McCain, that the invasion of South Ossetia by Georgia in August 8th, 2008, just as we were coming up to the presidential elections and John McCain was running for president, was designed to provoke a confrontation with Russia in a way that John McCain could demagogue it, that he could do some chest thumping and put Obama on the spot as having no foreign policy experience. What do you think?
Interesting theory. I have to look into it more. But I know as I'd put too much outside influence on Misha.
Mm-hmm.
Misha is a staunch nationalist. And one of the problems with these...
well, if he's such a nationalist, why did he retire to the United States?
Because he's afraid of ending up in jail.
Oh. Seriously? I mean, is they, because of the embezzlement? Those charges are actually haunting him?
Oh, there's all sorts of things. There's possibility of murder, too. A number of his head honchos are on trial right now. Once the election, the parliamentary election was over and the Georgian Dream Party took power, people just lined up at the prosecutor's office and filed complaints. And a number of the top people are on trial right now.
Wow. Wow.
Have been for a while, or are in jail. Actually, his basically second in command, Marisha, I can't pronounce it right.
Yeah.
Anyway, his first name is Vano. He's in jail right now without bail, and he was head of the Interior Ministry for a while. He was basically Misha's second guy.
And what's he in jail for?
Misuse of public funds, a few other things.
Yeah, remarkable.
That's usually what they do is they misuse public funds.
Yeah.
The mayor of Tbilisi has been accused of hiring people on the city payroll who are basically campaign workers.
For his own campaign, for mayor.
Yeah. Or yeah. For the Nationals campaign.
Yeah. This is like the old Boss Tweed stuff, only on steroids.
Yeah. Actually, part of the problem is a lot of the old Soviet habits die hard.
Yeah. 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 And that was very much a kind of crony system. Very interesting. Paul, thanks a lot for the call. You always give me food for thought. I appreciate it. Great to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So back to Rick Perry, who cut off the health care for, or is not providing health care to Israel Hilton and all these others. What would you call him? And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's see who's calling from Free Speech TV. Philip at Greenfield, Illinois. Hey, Philip, you wanted to comment on the Heritage Foundation?
Yes, Tom, I do. I received an envelope yesterday about 2 o'clock in the afternoon in my mailbox. It was the biggest envelope I've ever received. And it was a ballot in there to send back saying that I didn't want any tax increases.
Mm-hmm.
I got so mad, so upset, that I tore it all up, and because I know what it was about without ever looking at it. It was about no tax increases for the wealthy and the corporations. It wasn't about taxes for me.
Right.
And anyway, let's see, what else? Oh, I couldn't figure out why in the world they were sending this to me.
Mm-hmm.
And then I figured it. I called Huckabee on Fox one time.
Uh-huh.
I called her to tell him that I was for Obamacare.
Right.
Well, they do is take that call, and it's a yes. You don't have any choice of yes or no. If you make the call, it's a yes. So anyway, that's how they got my name and so forth, was from me calling Huckabee. I never talked to anybody, but they got it from me calling her.
Could be.
I'm almost positive of it.
Well,
I'm a Democrat and have been ever since.
Yeah, but you just never know who, you know. I mean, the mailing lists these days, it could be that you bought a product from a website that seems to be affiliated with some conservative cause. I mean, or that they've just identified you as somebody who's politically active. When you call a toll-free number, your phone number does show up on the caller ID. This is how, you know, regular callers to our program know that Danielle will answer the phone and say, hello, Philip. You know, she knows in advance it's you because our software builds a database of people who've called. And then, you know, when you call in, if you've called before and she's already put in your name and city, it just pops right up. So she knows when she answers the phone. But that's all we have is your name and phone number. I mean, to get your postal address, we would have to call you up and ask you. That's like when I give away a book or something. I have to put people on hold. So, and we don't store or keep that information or sell it or anything like that. So I'm skeptical that, although I guess there are these reverse lookup phone directories where you can take phone numbers and track down people's addresses from them if you subscribe to the services. I've seen them offered on the Internet. I don't know how well they work or not.
I don't know how they picked me out, but they did.
Yeah.
The other thing, there's one other thing, and I'll make this real quick.
Sure.
The IRS scandal. Now, I'm not a tax lawyer.
Right.
But how in the world can anybody get a tax exemption when it's not charity? I don't understand that at all.
We need a serious overhaul of our nonprofit laws. I'm strongly of the opinion Lyndon Johnson was the one who gave tax exemptions to churches in the United States. And I think that we should, you know, I have no problem with giving a tax exemption to a monastery because they really have no way of earning any money. But beyond that, I don't think that we should be giving tax exemptions to anybody who is not engaged in genuine nonprofit work. You know, schools should all be not-for-profit. In fact, we should forbid the profit motive. Hospitals, ditto. Those are appropriate nonprofits. A soup kitchen, a shelter, homeless shelter, schools. They should not be run by the profit motive. There should be a nonprofit status for them. But these lobbying firms and these think tanks, no, not a chance. Philip, thank you for the call. 10 minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Congressman, former Congressman Bob Ney, the author of Sideswiped, the book about how Washington really works, and Bob's experience in the midst of that sausage grinder. On the line with us with the Talk Radio News Service brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. What's going on in the world?
In the world of D.C., I haven't seen drama like this in months. And that was the drama associated with the debt ceiling vote.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the way John Boehner yesterday caught the members by surprise after the Republicans in a closed conference were talking about fundraising, and he walked up to the mic and he said, we're going to pass a clean debt bill, debt ceiling limit, and it's going to go until 2015. And he stared at everybody and went to sit down, turned to one of the Tea Party members of the House, and he said, I just took the monkey off your back. Can't you at least applaud? So that's
Whoa.
The front of the House.
Whoa. That's what that's what actually happened. So you've got the inside information here. That's what actually...
It happened. That's what happened. And they're reporting to the media, but I had a friend of mine that obviously told me about this, and he said it was that Boehner stared at everybody. Nobody said a word. People sat up because they were, you know, half asleep. It was the morning.
Right.
Stared at him. And the room was, you could drop the pin, and he waited, and then he sat down, and then he pointed a finger and said, come on, got the monkey off your back. And then a few people applauded, nobody cheered.
Amazing.
But
now,
then,
question, if I may, real quickly.
Sure.
Does John Boehner start drinking early in the morning? I mean, was he already lit up?
He was sedate on something. He was... He's a drinker, and I was too. So I'm not, you know, taking.
No, I understand that. I'm just curious if he's okay.
He might have had a glass of wine to sedate this one because it was incredible.
Yeah.
Then the other drama was just as we're speaking basically today in the Senate, you had Ted Cruz all excited. As you know, he's heading into Hampshire. He looks in the mirror and he sees the next president, and Senator Cruz was already in primed, but. It ended up that Mitch McConnell and John Cornyn, the minority leader and a minority whip, both Republicans, one from Kentucky, one from Texas, those two provided Senator Harry Reid, the Democratic leader of the Senate, the two votes, because they were two votes short of the 60-vote cloture rule to hear the debt ceiling bill, and those two waited, but they provided the votes. Then they went on, 67-31, to stop Ted Cruz from a filibuster, and then went on to actually pass the debt ceiling bill, sending it to the president on a 55-43 vote. Unbelievable.
So Ted Cruz was standing there with his, you know, in the wind.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. I mean, I thought this would have a little bit of play. Now, I think where the Republicans are wrong on this when they say, well, you know, they're saving them. Well, actually, what Boehner, somebody told me, he said, well, he's saving the Tea Party from itself. But I think where they're wrong, they think now this issue is gone and there is but one issue, be it Obamacare, is what they're telling me.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what? You ride one issue like that and, you know, the White House, you know, does a few things and things are clarified. More people sign up even than have signed up. And guess what? Other issues will surface. So, but it was an amazing drama day, Tom, in the Capitol.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. Okay, what else is going on in the world, Bob?
Well, I did want to mention the Director of National Intelligence, which I don't know if they should give him that title, but James Clapper, he acknowledged before the Senate Armed Services Committee that, and this was yesterday, that a year after Edward Snowden, you know, scraped all the information, that they have not corrected the ability of others to not do that. So they still haven't made the changes.
Wait a minute. So the 70% of the NSA budget that is private contractors, all those people who are not government employees and therefore have no access to the whistleblower protections and things, the only way that they could do anything is by the way that Snowden did, I would say. That those people still have the ability to pull an Ed Snowden on us or on,
yes.
on Clapper?
Clapper confirms that Snowden used a web crawler, you know, which is a common piece of software to sweep up the documents. And then he's acknowledging before the committee that nearly a year after Snowden did this, the technology wasn't yet in place to prevent another incident. So
he's
most likely saying it's there now, but it went a year, a complete year.
That's incredible.
Which is amazing, because they say, don't worry about us collecting. We've got it secured. When they even a year after Snowden scraped the information.
Well, and Snowden was saying, I could listen into the president's phone calls if I wanted. All I'd have to do is know his phone number. And it's like...
Amazing.
So, and that's and he was a low-level functionary, basically.
Just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So what else?
The only other thing was Janet Yellen... the new chair of the Federal Reserve, I think, gave an outstanding performance, really, at the House Financial Services Committee. She basically said that the Fed would continue to cut back its monthly bond purchases unless there was a notable change, and she wasn't going to jump to conclusions because there's some disappointing job growth in December and January. She said, don't jump to conclusions on this. There's a long-term trend here. So she really gave maybe a boring presentation, but she...
Which is what they wanted.
Came off well.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, boring is good if you're getting it from the Fed chairman, you don't, or
that's
chairperson,
right.
Whatever.
Boring is okay.
Yeah, you don't want the chairperson of the Fed to be going, oh, well, you know, I think that we'll raise interest rates by 6 points. You know, it's... What could happen? Or, you know, we'll give another couple $1 trillion to the banks. I mean, what could go wrong? Jamie Dimon gets another... Yeah.
Yes. And then the only other thing is that the entire Senate Republican caucus on Tuesday sent a second letter to the president saying that they want him to approve the Keystone pipeline. So they are lockstep on.
Yeah, of course. They're all in the bag of big oil. So what's the deal with Rand Paul suing the president over the drone program?
Yes, you know, I mean,
or was it not over the drone program? Oh, it was over the NSA. It was over NSA spy. Yeah.
And I understand people do things for attention. You can, you know...
You think this is the opening shot in his campaign for president of the United States?
Yes, I think it is. But, you know, you don't sue the president. We can't be. You can't be sued in Congress. You can't sue people for their official actions. Now, you can file court briefs for other things, but it's attention getter. I think it's...
Yeah, really, the only recourse that a member of Congress has against the president is to impeach them. Is that not the case?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's it.
Huh. Okay. Bob Ney, former congressman and author of Sideswiped, a brilliant book about the inner workings of Washington, D.C. that will curl your hair. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Tom.
Good talking.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIXWix.com. Everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
Listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Well, I've been promising you this all day. You know, when some conservative calls up and goes, well, you know, we need a little survival of the fittest here. You know, it's just, you know, Congress not extending unemployment benefits. It's just a fine thing. Those people should be weeded out of the gene pool. Right. Did Darwin really say that? Let's ask David Loy, the psychologist, evolutionary systems scientist, founder of the Darwin Project. The website is thedarwinproject.com, author of many books, his latest, Darwin in Love, the rest of the story, and his personal website, davidloy.com. Professor Loy, it's great to talk with you again.
Well, it's great to be here, Tom.
Thank you.
I have to tell you, though, this is my initial flight on Skype, and I feel like I'm an astronaut all with all these instruments around me taking off for the moon. So,
well,
please excuse me.
No, it seems to be working just fine. And
okay, great.
Yeah, you're the John Glennon for the day, and he did a fine job too. So, tell us what is wrong with this story that we all learned in high school, and that was then regurgitated by economists, that Charles Darwin said that only the fittest survive, and that evolution was really all about the strongest crushing the weakest, and eventually thus strengthening the gene pool or the body politic or the body economic, and it all works out for the best.
Well, that's only half. It's a half truth. It isn't even a half truth. That's only half of what Darwin really set out and wrote and did the research for and was trying to convey, and that's been ignored for 100 years, over 100 years. Though a lot of scientists now, European and Asian, as well as American leading scientists, are endorsing and pushing what I've uncovered. And what I've uncovered is the rest of Darwin, in which he moves on. It's all there in quotes. The most dramatic thing I've found to get it across quickly is the difference. See, I did this study of the descent of man. I was a co-founder of two international organizations for the study of advanced research on evolution. And it came to me that we were all doing this, and I got no sense that anybody had ever bothered to read Darwin other than just plug it in.
Mm-hmm.
So one night I took a copy of, I had an automated copy, a computerized copy of The Descent of Man, ran some word counts, and I found that he only wrote twice about survival of the fittest. In The Descent of Man, which he tells us, I'm now moving on to human level, to our level.
Right.
He only writes twice. Once is to apologize. And in contrast, I put in the word love to see what would happen. He writes 95 times about love. And with a single item in the index that is still, in all the editions I know of, used universally, one item in the index, 95 times he's writing about love.
Wow.
Now, the other thing that, the other little simple set of statistics that really sort of slams it across and brings it to life was that you take selfishness, all this stuff about selfish genes, you know, and we've got to support these predators because they're going to give us, they're going to trickle down a little from the one percenters. We'll get a little of that, and, you know, that sort of thing. Well, you go to selfishness and you enter it in the computerized version. He says, this is a direct quote. He says, selfishness is a base principle accounting for the low morality of savages. This is what he's writing.
And base in his time meant a negative, a foul, awful.
Yeah, a base, yeah. A disgusting principle. And in contrast, I found that I was amazed at how many times he was talking about writing about something to do with morality, the moral right. sense, moral sensitivity, and so on.
So he mentioned love 95 times. What was the context? What was he saying about love?
Well, he was saying what he really, in effect, wound up saying is, love is one of the most powerful forces driving evolution. But on the selfishness thing, in contrast there, he's writing 92 times about moral sensitivity. So in effect, he's saying, to cut to the chase, he's saying, look, natural selection, variation, that's well established. And it's, unfortunately, it's been degraded into this idea of selfish.
The virtue of selfishness, yeah.
Yeah, the
so-called
the survival of the fittest. But he says at our human level of evolution, we move on. We grow up. We mature into a higher order of and higher agencies. This is a direct quote. Higher agencies take over. And I've got the quote here. I can come back to it later. But but he's saying that the in effect, here's a quick comparison. In effect, he's saying the first half of Darwin's theory that I wrote out in Origin of Species is like the big rocket that shoves the rocket into space. It breaks through. But he says the rest of the theory is like a secondary rocket that is then boosted and takes off and reaches the destination. The other doesn't reach the destination. The other the destination of the other is death, suicide for the planet.
Yeah.
It's the
Darwin used a metaphor of rockets?
No.
Oh, you are.
That's me.
Okay.
Trying to get across on the behalf of this poor guy that was so misinterpreted and so mangled and misdirected all these years.
So, my understanding was that it was, correct me if I'm wrong on the name, and I probably am, Herbert Spencer or somebody like that, who was his nephew, who basically took survival of the fittest and turned it into an economic theory?
The phrase is from Spencer.
Yeah.
The only reason that Darwin ever used it was that Alfred Wallace, the other part of the theory of evolution, Darwin was saying, in effect, you know, I'm having a hell of a time getting across this concept of natural selection and interaction with variation.
Right.
What'll I do? And so Wallace says, well, use Spencer's term, survival of the fittest. He did. He did only twice and regretted ever using it.
So Spencer originated the term, the economist.
Oh, yeah.
And then Darwin used it. I thought it was either. That's fascinating. But basically, in the minute we have left here, David Loy, the essence of Darwin's message is that if humans are to evolve forward societally or even biologically, we have to do through cooperation and love.
Yeah.
And the selfishness is a counter evolutionary principle.
Oh, yeah, very much so. Do we have more than 1 minute?
No, we have about 30 seconds.
Oh, gosh.
It's all yours. That's a fair amount of time.
Okay. Well, last night watching the Olympics, I saw the whole thing right there, the first half and the second half. You see all these people, all these wonderful youngsters out there striving, fighting against each other, you know, the winner against the loser and so on. but you see there's another side to it. You see a lot of hugging going on out there.
Yep.
You see this transcendent feeling of oneness and a gratitude.
Yep. The team, the support network, all those things. That's a brilliant observation. David Loy. The websites are davidloy.com and thedarwinproject.com. Hang on just a second here.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
His newest book, Darwin in Love, The Rest of the Story, available now. But David, thank you so much for being with us.
It's available on all the online booksellers worldwide.
There you go. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And David, in Occidental, California, you had some thoughts on John McCain and Misha Saakashvili.
Yeah, actually, you had an earlier caller who basically said what I was going to say. And basically, Saakashvili can't go back to Georgia because he'd end up in jail. But with McCain, I wanted to wish you a happy Lincoln's birthday.
Well, thank you. That's Monday, isn't it?
No, that's today.
Oh, it is.
It's the 12th.
Wow. Don't
you remember? We're the same age, Tom.
Uh-huh.
And don't you remember, we always got Lincoln and Washington's birthday off? And now
yeah, that's right. It used to be. But now they combined it and they call it President's Day, and that's next Monday. And, yeah, you're right. Okay. Yeah.
Right.
Thank you.
And just one little thing about Lincoln. He was the original president who warned us about the power of corporations and money and worried that they were going to take over the nation and
Yeah.
After the Civil War.
Yeah, I quoted him to that effect in Unequal Protection.
Uh-huh. Okay. But that's kind of a sidelight. I just wanted to mention Lincoln.
But back to Saakashvili.
Right. But it's really about McCain. So McCain has this habit, and I don't know if he's really CIA or what, but like McCain was in Ukraine back in December.
And now Ukraine is melting down.
Right. McCain is everywhere where we're taking over their government.
Huh.
And you were talking about Ukraine, and if you talk to Stephen Cohen, who's a professor at the
I'm going to interview him tonight on television.
Oh, great. Because I've listened to him for years, and he's very knowledgeable about everything Soviet Union-ish.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. He's got a piece coming out in The Nation magazine, he should characterize it rather than me, but my takeaway, I've read it, or I read a good piece of it, and it essentially was, why are we engaging in this hysteria? You know, why are we returning to this Cold War mentality? And blowing a hole in a lot of these arguments that are made about, you know, the evil Russia. And which is not to say Russia doesn't have its problems. But, you know, here in the United States, we have more prisoners per capita and in absolute numbers than any place on earth. I mean, you know, every country has something that they should, correct and they could rightly be ashamed of.
Right.
So anyway, I'm looking forward to that conversation. I think Stephen Cohen and his wife Katrina Vandenhoevel have just done brilliant work with The Nation and just generally spreading a rational, not even just a progressive message, but just a rational message. You know, how do we have peace in this world?
Right.
So, very interesting.
But the thing with McCain, you're talking about the Keating Five,
right?
McCain is the only person that remained in the Senate after the Keating Five.
Yeah, there was a couple who resigned. Were any of them prosecuted of those five?
I don't remember anybody getting prosecuted, but John Glenn left the Senate.
Right.
And so did Alan Cranston.
Right. Very interesting. David, thank you for the call. And thank you for watching Free Speech TV. We will be back with more. It's 20 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program on Free Speech TV and all over the world. Stick with us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Bobby in Mountain View, California, listening to AM 760. Hey, Bobby, what's up?
Hello, Tom. How are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
You know, I grew up with rich kids, I remember, in the 80s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And from what I remember, they always had nice cars and the parents always lived on the nice side of town, right? But they didn't seem to be astronomically rich. And I know rich people today, and the difference is, you know, the people I knew that were rich in the 80s, they would go to France, you know, their parents would have nice vacations in France and Hawaii, but now they own villas and chateaus in France and Hawaii. Do you know what I'm saying? I don't think it's just in my imagination that people are buying islands now instead of just going there on vacation, right? And in the 70s, I think that top 1% owned about 15% of the country, and now it's maybe half of the country.
I don't have the statistics in front of me, but and it's not quite as bad as you're saying, but for the top 1%, maybe the top 10%, or the top 5%. But, yes, what has happened, this is the absolute predicted consequence of Reaganomics. If you massively cut taxes at the top and raise taxes on working people, which is what Reagan did, he doubled the payroll tax and then he cut the income tax. And people on the top are paying income taxes. People in the bottom at the time of Reagan, it was the first $30,000 of income that you earned, paid all, you know, paid full payroll tax on 100% of their income. And the logical consequence of that is the rich get richer, and the working class goes from being the middle class to being the working poor.
And about $7 an hour, right? About $50 a day. But I wonder if they're looking at the wrong gauge, instead of tying minimum wage to productivity, they should tie it to dollars in creation, right? We've got tens and tens and tens of trillions of dollars in creation. Where the minimum wage was, say, $4 an hour in the 80s, where there was only maybe $10 trillion in creation, right?
And what do you mean by creation?
Credit creation, right? Just dollars.
Oh, you're talking about, like, you know, total money floating around in the economy.
And it might be $100 trillion. Some people predict. Some people it's hard to track the math of dollars that have been created.
Yeah.
But in the 80s, it was about 10 to 20 trillion. That includes all credit cards, all debts. Now it's about $100 trillion. But the minimum, you know how supply and demand, there's more dollars in existence. Right. They're worth less.
Yeah.
Who knows what the minimum wage should be in order to keep up with that amount of dollar devaluation?
Right, and the thing that devalues those dollars, by the way, is not that the Fed is printing them. The way that we bring dollars into existence in the United States is by banks loaning money. And so as we go deeper and deeper in debt, we are deflating our own currency. And the debt of, you know, we have a debt bomb in the United States. It's the, you know, we look at the national debt, the public debt, and it's, what, $14, $15 trillion. But the private debt in the United States is $54 trillion. And that's a massive problem. That is, and in fact, that's money that was all, you know, created onto the balance sheets of banks because of our fractional reserve banking system. So, yeah, I'm with you, Bobby. Thanks for the call, and thanks for, you know, and by the way, Ellen Brown is the person who really knows this stuff. Go over to webofdebt.com is her website, and that's also the title of her book. Cora, listening in Taos, New Mexico to KVOT. Hey, Cora.
Yes, Tom, I remember you recently said something about you wouldn't be surprised that Mitt Romney would run again, and, I mean, it would probably be his last attempt to become president, and certainly he would be a good candidate for the neocons. He was the one that said Russia was our greatest enemy.
Yes.
So
in the debates,
I think all this is kind of working hand in hand.
Yeah, I think so too. I don't think it's just because. I really think that the neocons, the Republicans, and the military-industrial complex, we need a boogeyman. You know, they're all sitting around going, you know, we got to be afraid of somebody, and you know we can't make it China because we're doing too much business with China. We don't want to hurt our business interests. And we can't make it Al-Qaeda because everybody laughs at you now when you get hysterical about Al-Qaeda. So let's go back to the tried and true, it used to be the Soviet Union. It's Russia.
Right.
It's incredible.
I just think it's, you know, their little, you know, feelers out there that they're just, you know, putting this. And like I said, I'm sure Romney realizes this is his last chance. And with Christie going down, you know, who does that leave, really? You know?
Yeah. Well, that's what I was saying a couple of weeks ago when Christie started going down in flames, is that the corporatist Republicans really are going to have to turn to Mitt Romney because Christie was their guy, you know, the Wall Street Republicans. And Ted Cruz is not their guy, and Rand Paul is definitely not their guy. And, you know, the Huckabees of the world, you know, they'll shill for them, but they don't really have a deep understanding. And they've got weird agendas, and they probably can't get elected. You know, Rick Santorum, nobody, you know, some guy who takes his wife's miscarriage fetus home in a jar and puts it on the mantle over the fireplace. I mean, really, you're going to make this guy president of the United States? I mean, it's just too weird, you know.
Yeah.
And don't, for whatever you do, don't Google the word Santorum. So what are the Republicans going to do? I mean, and then they say Scott Walker, but Scott Walker's in the middle of a scandal in Wisconsin. I mean, they've got this John Doe investigation where the federal prosecutors are sniffing around Scott Walker for all kinds of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Well, I'm sure Romney would be willing to spend a great deal of his own money, though, too. So that's an added bonus.
Yeah, and there's that. And he may well be a billionaire, and nobody knows because he won't tell us. But his partners all became billionaires, or several of them became billionaires. So there's every reason to believe that he became a billionaire. And, you know, so if you're a billionaire and you spend, you know, 20-30% of that to be, you know, become elected president, a couple hundred million dollars, you still have hundreds of millions of dollars. It's not like you're ever going to have to worry about, you know, unemployment insurance. Cora, thank you for the call. I think you're right. I think you're onto something. It's 28 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, the place where smart people get their news. And Misha Saakashvili, I just find this fascinating, this op-ed in today's New York Times, what's not in there.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And Mr. Israel Hilton now, dying of brain cancer in Texas without insurance, thanks to Rick Perry. What do you call Rick Perry? Senator John McCain's top foreign policy advisor prepped his boss for an April 17 phone call with the president of Georgia, that's Misha Saakashvili, and then helped prepare a strong statement supporting the fledgling republic. The day of the call, a lobbying firm partly owned by that advisor signed a $200,000 contract to continue providing strategic advice to the Georgian government in Washington. Okay, Senate Democrats fell one vote short of advancing a bill to restore long-term unemployment. And writing for the Huffington Post, Arthur Delaney is apparently the author of this. Oh, and Sam Stein, the two of them. When that happened, Russ Holton wept. He said, imagine that, a 44-year-old man crying while watching TV. He watched the vote on C-SPAN. The next day, the cable provider cut off his bill for non-service, for non-payment. 6 years ago, he'd been making $85,000 a year. This is incredible. Senate Republicans filibustering an extension of unemployment. That's just incredible. Andrew in Hollywood, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Andrew, what's on your mind?
So, hey, is that me, Tom?
Yeah. You wanted to comment on our Darwin segment?
Yeah, that was really good. And a takeaway that I had, following what he said in your comment, I think he said cooperation was the key for us to evolve, you know, and maybe survive as a species.
Mm-hmm.
And live better. And he was talking about sports and how he was seeing a lot of hugging and et cetera between competitors. And yeah, you commented, he saw a lot of people on the teams doing that. And I think also we need to mention also that he probably sees them hugging not only their own teammates, but people from other teams, et cetera.
Yeah.
And, you know, the highest form of sports, and maybe that's what you were saying too, but I think the highest form of sports, like, is loving your competitor and not trying to destroy them. And that's what we need to do is, you know, love each other, the people that are close to us, but also everyone, our enemies. And we do that by not wanting to destroy them, but wanting to hopefully enlighten them and educate them. And then only use violence when necessary and only to the point of disarming them.
Yes, I think it's very well said, Andrew. Thank you very much. Very well said. And in fact, I would take that a step further and say that the principle of cooperation and collaboration is not only, you know, what would be useful to take us to the next stage of evolution or whatever, but that is the core of it's at the heart of biology. Your body, for example, I mean, just like the entire ecosystem around us, this is fractal. I can talk about our bodies. You could just as easily talk about your community. You could just as easily talk about the ecosystem of your state or of the nation or of the entire globe. But your body is a cooperative organism. You know, your liver doesn't compete with your kidneys. Your lungs don't compete with your stomach. And when the time comes that some piece of, you know, your kidneys or your liver or something decides to compete with everything else to try and get more nutrients, we have a word for that in the medical lexicon. It's called cancer. Competition is cancer. Cooperation is the natural way of biology of the world. Cooperation and collaboration. And you find, whether you find that, and that doesn't mean that the fox doesn't eat the bunny. Right. But you know, nature organizes it in such a way that there's lots of bunnies and a smaller number of foxes. And then there's, you know, the fox has something to look out for, too. I don't know what it is right off the top of my head, but maybe us. But, you know, there's an equilibrium in nature. And the tooth and claw and fang, I think, has been overemphasized from out of the Department of Redundancy Department there, to the point that we have lost track of the necessary collaboration, the collaborative efforts of nature. And in fact, without the fox weeding out well, now we're back to the survival of the fittest. So anyhow, Steve in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I was curious to see if you knew about the Chevron Marsalis shale well explosion yesterday.
No, I don't.
It was about,
tell me about it.
About 50 miles south of Pennsylvania, south of Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
in Greene County, Pennsylvania. Okay. And I was on Common Dreams last night, and I saw it was a breaking news report, and I scoured every news station last night to see if there was a report on it, and no one was reporting on it at all.
Hmm.
And this morning I went on to the local station in Pittsburgh, and they had a nice piece on it. And they actually have a nice video on there showing the fire. There's one person that's missing who's unaccounted for.
Wow.
And one person who was injured, and they're not letting any of the fire the department, you know, the fire department around the fire yet, so that it's going to be burning, they said, for at least 2 or 3 days. And it's a massive, massive fire out there right now.
Now, if somebody had called the press and said, I saw somebody in a turban near there, and the word got out, this would have been a nationwide,
all over.
We'd be locking down, we'd be going to DEFCON 5 or something. But because it wasn't a guy in a turban, because in all probability it was a bunch of guys in suits who set up the conditions for a mine to blow up, which is usually the case. No droids in this car. Just keep on moving. Keep on moving. Fascinating. I have, you know, Steve, I usually check Common Dreams every day. It's one of the regular news sources that I hit. I haven't in the last 24 hours. It's been a pretty hectic, it's been a very hectic week. And but thanks for the heads up. I'm going to go looking for that, and maybe I'll be riffing on it tomorrow. Thank you very much for
that. Thank you.
I appreciate that. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom?
Good. You have advice for the left about Benghazi?
Yeah, I think the Bank of Bahrain getting a loan for billions at 0.5% while your students are paying 6.25%,
mm-hmm.
which is over 10%, 10 times as much. What we need to do to get this bill into Congress, could you tell me?
Well, Bernie Sanders and others, I mean, there have been numerous bills sponsored to cover student debt, or more importantly, to make school, you know, college free and trade schools free in the United States, like they were after World War II, by and large, at least for returning GIs, and or close to free like they were when I was a kid. Inexpensive enough that you can work a part-time job at a burger shack and put yourself through college. But they consistently meet with fierce opposition. You've got the entire for-profit school industry, which in my mind should not even exist. We should ban for-profit schools. But they have become a major force in Congress, huge lobbying body, and large donors to the campaigns, particularly of Republicans, but also increasingly to Democrats. The for-profit, not just colleges, but for-profit charter schools and things like that.
The banks right now.
And then you got Wall Street.
They're all right there on Wall Street. They're these things. Why can't we just go straight from the Fed to us students like the banks do?
Yeah.
I don't understand.
We could. We could. It would just take an act of Congress. And the problem is that because the Supreme Court said that the First Amendment protects money, and the 14th Amendment protects corporations, you have these moneyed corporations, these private school businesses and these banksters who are offering student loans. We've gone from virtually no student debt in this country before Reagan came into office to over $1 trillion for the student debt. Now it's exceeded credit card debt.
My wife and I combined, we have a master's and a PhD combined, and we have about $80,000. I got my master's, I'm paying 6.25. My wife and I combined it's like about down to 58. We're still being paid on for like 14 years. I only knocked off a few $1,000 off it.
That's insane. That's insane. And see, that's money that 15 years ago, if you didn't have that debt when you got out of school, you would have been buying a house. You'd be building equity. By the time you're my age, you'd have something, for your retirement or for whatever. But instead, I see an entire lost generation. People people talk about millennials and Gen X and Gen Y. What we really have is people who came of age and lived in the economy before Reaganomics under the New Deal, and people who came of age and live in the economy after Reaganomics, and they're the Reaganomics generation. And the Reaganomics generation are just plain old flat-out screwed.
Oh, totally. Generation F, we should call it.
Or Generation R for Reaganomics. Let's not go to words you can't say on the radio. But, yeah, I get what you're saying, Jeff, and I totally agree with you. Was that a one-minute cue, Shane? Okay, 20 seconds. Okay, so, Jeff, do you have a specific solution? I mean, mine is let's just wipe out all student loan debt, period, and reboot the entire educational system.
Well, that would be great, but I would just like something we could get started to where, a lot of us are caught in this catch-22 to where if you had these loans before 2003, you don't qualify for this new program.
Right.
But make us all qualify no matter when we got it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good suggestion, too. I mean, thank you, Jeff. Thanks for the call. I think that we should just view education as national infrastructure. And it's like, we're just going to pay for the infrastructure, our educational infrastructure.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's really our intellectual infrastructure. And we used to invest in that, and we had a huge return on that investment. Welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour. Jim just pointed out, looking at that picture there, this is a live shot of the U.S. Capitol, and all the limousines pulling up in front of the Senate side there. So the Senate must just have gotten out, and all the senators are, racing to the airport to get out before Snowmageddon hits. Very, very interesting. Very interesting. Kathy in Aetna, Wyoming. Hey, Kathy, what's on your mind today? You wanted to talk about health care?
Yes, sir. The elephant in the room, or should I say the elephant on our nation, to me, is the health insurance industry. I think that they're the ones that really have a lot of moral problems and ethical problems. And if memory serves me, there was a 17-year-old girl in California that needed a liver transplant, and her parents had insurance, but the insurance wouldn't allow her to have the transplant, and they were pleading and begging on television, and people were protesting, trying to help this family. And then it was like a couple of days before the little girl passed away, the insurance company finally relented and gave in to give her the transplant, but at that point it was too late.
Right.
So I think that they're really the bad guys. I mean, because there are many, many stories like that. And just one more thing, if I may add, you know, the Republicans want to talk about how powerful and giving that church organizations are,
mm-hmm.
and that they can help people, so we don't need all the welfare and health programs to help people. Well, you know, Texas has some of the largest church organizations in the country, and they're very rich and powerful. Why don't they pitch in and help this gentleman, Israel? And maybe, if it's not too late for Israel, maybe he can get some help.
Yeah, it's an excellent point, Kathy. And apropos of your original metaphor, rather than the health insurance companies being the elephant in the room, I would say that they're the leech on the body politic, because they're really sucking the blood out. Elephants are pretty benign. In fact, they're quite friendly. They're very social and gregarious, and they mourn when a member of their community dies. So can we change the metaphor slightly?
Absolutely.
Okay. These are the bloated leeches. Thank you, Kathy. Great hearing from you. Sherman in New York City listening on WBAI. You disagree with my theory on the monetary system? What does that mean?
Well, no, more about just some clarity. You agree that federal government spending is not restrained by revenue, correct, in terms of taxing and borrowing?
Yes, of course.
Okay. Well, sometimes you make arguments that don't have that as a basis. And I think, like yesterday, you were talking about Social Security.
Right.
And, you know, FICA doesn't pay for Social Security. I mean, the government can spend as much money as it wants to, only constraints would be inflation, obviously.
Well, but except that Social Security has never, to the best of my knowledge, has never gone in the red. It is a separate budget item. I mean, the locks box that Al Gore talked about doesn't exist, but there is a firewall. Social Security is funded by a separate tax from the general revenue, and it is not paid out of general revenue. So while technically and legally, although I'm not sure how the Social Security law was written, there may be something in there prevents it from going into the red. But, you know, the reason why there's this, you know, $2.5 trillion trust fund right now is because in 80, Reagan saw the rabbit moving through the python of the boomer generation and said, okay, we're going to double tax one generation. They're going to pay not only for their parents' retirement, but for their own as well. And so since 1982, we have been paying double. I mean, he literally doubled the Social Security tax to accumulate this enormous amount of money that would then, you know, be paid back down when those people retired. But Sherman, I'm sorry we're hitting a break. Call back another time and we'll have a longer and more thoughtful conversation about monetary policy in the U.S. budget. I would love to. So I'm suggesting that when Israel Hilton dies, and his doctors say he's going to die in about 18 months, and he's dying unnecessarily, or at least unnecessarily early, because he didn't have health insurance and doesn't have health insurance because Rick Perry created, you know, or is participating along with 24 other states in the red state Republican donut hole where you make too much to qualify for Medicare and not enough to qualify for Obamacare. Israel Hilton was making around $13,000 a year and $13,334 to be exact. And for a guy with a family, that's not enough for Obamacare, and that's too much for Medicare. And so he just doesn't qualify for health insurance, basically. And he has brain cancer. And they cut him open and took out what they could. But they couldn't get all of it. And had they got it a whole lot earlier, when he first went to the ER, when he first started complaining about these problems, he would not be dying right now. So what do you call Rick Perry? What do you call that? I call it negligent homicide, which is a subset of murder, I believe. And so you charge somebody with murder. Dell, in Hayesville, North Carolina, you have a different theory about what you should call Rick Perry.
Yes. Thank you for taking my call.
My pleasure.
And you're talking about cancer or the body. And we have cancer of the government.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as I'm concerned, in Rick Perry and Ted Cruz, you can't do anything about stupidity.
So
that's my comment.
Okay. So I call it murder. You call it stupid. I there might be a large element of that, although murderers sometimes you look at it and go, why did he do that? You know, well, he's stupid. Preston in Denver, listening on AM 760. Hey, Preston. Climate change?
Yes, and I was thinking about how the news of climate change can feel so overwhelming, and the news about mountaintop removal to get the coal and the tar sands deforestation and the ocean acidification and so much else, and then the economic injustice going on to top it all off. But you were talking about Darwin in love and about evolution and cooperation, and I wanted to share some thoughts of and some examples of how that's going on, where I see it going on. For example, so many civic organizations and faith communities that are active on climate and economic issues. The Unitarian churches and the Quakers across the country are doing great work, and also the business community. And we have allies in the business community, like the insurance industry and the ski industry, both of whom are very concerned about climate change issues.
Yeah, the reinsurance industry is actually the one that's most concerned about it because they backstop the insurance industry.
And I was wondering also, what are your thoughts about other approaches like natural capitalism? I know Al Gore and Bill Clinton both have been proponents of that. And what Van Jones wrote about, the green collar economy. I see those as being, you know, I'm not much.
I think all that stuff works, Preston, once you capture externalities. And that's the big piece of the equation that very few people are talking about. The fact that if we factored into the cost of a gallon of gas, the price to have the Fifth Fleet protect the ExxonMobil shipping lines from Saudi Arabia to wherever their port is on the East Coast or in the Gulf. If you factored into the cost of a gallon of gasoline at the tank or the price of oil or natural gas that's being used to power a power plant or whatever, if you factored into that the cost of the cancers that are the result of burning and releasing carbon fossil fuels and the pollution of the water caused by the reinjection of fracking liquids, which are in many cases simply the waste materials of refining processes of fossil fuels, of oil principally. If you factored in the cost for our coal power plants of these giant coal slurry, waste piles that are all over the United States that are now, one just, polluted a river in West Virginia yesterday. If all of that stuff was factored into the cost of these fossil fuels, they would become more expensive than wind and solar. And that would push the market in an appropriate direction. And then you could have your green collar economy, and then you could have your natural capitalism, all that kind of stuff. But as long as these guys control Congress, as long as they control the political agenda, as long as they control the media, much of the media agenda through the power of big money, because the Supreme Court said that money is protected by the First Amendment, as long as that's the case, it's going to be really, really hard to have those natural systems work the way they should. Am I making sense, Preston?
All very good points. Yeah. Thank you so much. I also wanted to point out, though, we do have some allies in local governments. I know some cities have actually gone beyond the Kyoto Protocol requirements. And, they're expanding their light rail. They're planting trees. They're putting up solar. They're building neighborhoods that make sense, mixed use, with homes and businesses, instead of, auto dependency with the suburban sprawl that we so often are. Yep. That's my conspiracy. I think the auto industrial complex has been doing some things that are incredibly inefficient and expensive and forces.
On the other hand, you've got, one of the car makers. I mean, I think the Chevy Volt is a masterpiece. A brilliant piece of engineering, and I expect to see a lot more, that kind of hybrid technology, mixed technology, true hybrid technology. And next year, one of the Japanese auto manufacturers is coming out with a hydrogen fuel cell car. So, step by step by step. Preston, thanks a lot for the call. Ed in Pleasant Plains, Illinois. We have a half a minute, Ed. It's yours.
Yeah, it's all I need. Hi, Tom. I hope you're doing well. That gentleman that was talking about that disaster somewhere in Pennsylvania, maybe, that he found that it was underreported.
Right.
I took a couple of incidents myself, like, did you know that there are strikes against Walmart and against the Hamburger King, whatever. And I went to my local stations one by one, and I talked to them, and there was no awareness.
They did not know. That's because we don't have news in America anymore. Reagan stopped enforcing the Fairness Doctrine in 87, and Clinton signed the Telecommunications Act in 96, and it's just been a disaster ever since. It's pretty amazing. Ed, thanks a lot for the call. And coming up tomorrow, more. Well, we'll see what Snowmageddon brings us, but hopefully I'll be here. I'll have a live program for you. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. It's not a spectator sport. You got to get out there and occupy something, even if it's just, go to pdamerica.org or movetoamend.org. Sign up, participate, tag your own. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the show. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard, count on them to help protect what makes you, you. WIX, Wix.com, everyone deserves to have their own stunning site, and it's free. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. ITM Trading, America's trusted source for rare coins and precious metals. Web.com, you say it, they will build it. Granger, for the ones who get it done. Boston Beer, America's leading brewer of handcrafted, full-flavored beers. Geico, 15 minutes could save you up to 15%. And EcoWine.com, your trusted source for organic wines since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.